My name is Corliss Askew Watkins. I am a mother of two, a wife of one. I am one of three children born to my mother, and I am a cancer fighter.
You identified yourself as a cancer fighter. I'm going to have you start there. This isn't an easy thing to talk about, but if you don't mind, if you could talk a little bit about your journey with cancer that's made you into a cancer fighter.
In 2009, I went home from work one day and I could barely walk up the steps to my house. And I actually fell asleep in the car. And finally, when I woke up, I said, oh, let me go on upstairs. So I went to do that and I got in the bed. When I got up about an hour or so later to go to the restroom, I got to the restroom and got back to my bed, but I couldn't get in the bed and I passed out. I ended up my husband had to call the paramedics, and they came to get me and took me to the hospital. And that was a Wednesday evening. And on Thursday, the doctor came in and told me that I had a tumor on the head of my pancreas. And they weren't sure whether it was malignant or benign. And so I had to get some work done. The reason I had passed out was that my hemoglobin was down to 4. And a normal range is 11 or higher. They were surprised that I was even able to drive home from work that day.
Do you remember what your frame of mind was that day?
My first thoughts were for my husband. He had already lost one wife to illness some time ago before I came into the picture. And I was just so concerned about him. It's like, oh no, you can't go through this again. And then my children, and I was like, well, what is going to happen here? So after the shock of that, which was really just that Thursday evening, I still remember the doctor who diagnosed me. After that Thursday evening, it was a prayer, and it was waiting to see what was going to happen, see what the results of the biopsy were going to be.
And then you got the results of the biopsy.
Then I got the results of the biopsy, and they were the tumor was malignant, and so we started on a course of trying to figure out, okay, so what can be done? I went to another physician, and they decided that they would do something called a Whipple. Whipple is where they go in, and I'm not a medical person, and it's been so long ago I haven't looked at everything, but I know that they had to take off part of my pancreas, and they had to rearrange a few things. They took off a part of my stomach, a part of my intestines. They had to reroute them in a different way. So the chances of me then becoming diabetic because of the changes to my pancreas were greater.
So you go through that, and then do we have a level of success?
We have a level of success, and for a couple of years, 2 years later, I went in for another surgery because by that time, some spots had shown up on my liver, and it was one of those surgeries where you go in, and they said, well, it'd probably be about 5 or 6 hours for the surgery, and it was only 2 because they said, no, there's nothing we can do.
That was what year? 2011?
2011.
So you go in for surgery. They say there's nothing they can do. Mm-hmm. So you start out finding out about pancreatic cancer. Then we move into spots on the liver. Go to surgery. You hear there's nothing we can do. Does that sound then to you like a death sentence, or how are you feeling?
I was of the frame of mind that I was terminal anyway. I do believe that when they went in 2009, that the spots were there, but they were too small for them to see. So then when they went in 2011, because my scans showed that there was something there, and they went in to see, well, could they do some of these new things like radio ablation and some other things to try to treat what was going on in the liver, they said no, that wouldn't work. So my family and friends being the praying people that they are, we continued to pray and to trust that God was going to work this out. And we started saying, well, what about a liver transplant? So everyone was telling me no. And then they were recommending me for several experimental things and trials and whatnot. I did do a little bit of chemo, and I did not like the way it made me feel. And I decided that the quality of my life was more important than the quantity. So I stopped the chemo. And they told me no, that I wasn't a candidate for a liver transplant for a number of reasons. One of which is that typically they don't transplant the liver if you have cancer that's metastasized to the liver. So they kept telling me no, that I wasn't a candidate. So that was in 2012. And then in 2013, all of a sudden they said, well, you could get a live donor. Well, we can put you on the list and then we'll have to see how we can get you some additional points to be able to be considered. So over the course of 2013 to 15, I was moving up the list.
And then finally, you get the liver transplant.
Yes, I get the liver transplant because my goddaughter, who is not a blood relative to me, was a perfect match, 99.9%.
And how does a liver transplant work?
So what happens is your liver is the only organ in the body that regenerates itself. So she was able to give me her left lobe, which is the smaller part of the liver, and it then grew back in me to the full size of the cavity where my liver, my own diseased liver, had been taken out. And her liver is back to its normal size. And that happens within 6 to 8 weeks. So now I have a healthy 30-year-old liver. In this moment, I'm showing no signs of cancer, of active cancer anyway. My belief is that my body still has the cancer cells. So that's why I say I'm a cancer fighter. So everything that I do is about fighting cancer. So even though I'm living my life cancer-free right now, I realize that it could come back. And I don't know when that might be.
You take nothing for granted.
I don't take anything for granted. I live each day to the fullest. I enjoy my profession, my work, my career. And so I put a lot into that. I have opportunities to be with family, and I take every opportunity to do that. I consider myself a miracle, a walking miracle, because there were so many things that fell into place through this journey.
What strikes me is that people told you, no, you're not a candidate for a liver transplant. There are a number of people who would take that and go home and just kind of start planning for the aftermath, right? What was different for you?
I think what's different for me is my faith, and I prayed about it. And for me, it was like, God, whatever you need to do to save me, to save someone else, however you want to use my life as an inspiration for others, then you just go ahead and do that. I'm prepared for that.
But you wouldn't take no for an answer.
I wouldn't take no for an answer because I believed that God had an answer. And I was okay with the answer being, you know, it's time for you to close your eyes and go to sleep. And at the same time, I didn't think that me not doing anything was the wise thing. So I continued to work, and my brother-in-law is a physician. And so I felt comfortable with him, and he was able to go and to some of my appointments and explain a lot of things to me. And so no wasn't in my vocabulary.
How do you go about advocating for yourself? Because I think that's a piece that a lot of people, especially women, don't know how to do.
Well, I kept at it with my doctors, and like I said, I wouldn't take no, and I would say, well, what about this, and what about this, and what about this? And I would encourage anyone to take an advocate with you. Take somebody there who can take notes while you're hearing what's going on, what's being said to you, because that helps to bring clarity once you get home and all of these questions come up. And that's what I did. Sometimes it was my brother-in-law. Sometimes it was my my sister friend who is a nurse. But I got somebody to go with me. So constantly asking questions. Well, why can't I do such and such? That helped me to figure out, okay, well, what do I need to do? And my transplant was done at UCSF. So I had doctors there because my Kaiser doctors gave me the referral. And I had to go before the tumor board. It wasn't just that, but they would make the case. And I think they saw how dedicated, committed I was to, okay, let's take this the next step. What's the next step?
I'm going to go back just a little bit. I'm thinking back to when you get your initial news, you know, you're thinking of all the possible scenarios. The thing that caught my ear is that you said, first, my heart went out to my husband. I was worried about him. Then I started thinking about my children. How have you found a level of balance between being such a loving, caring, giving person and then also creating the space to really take care of yourself?
In 2009, when I found out, I did not want any of the students at the school to know, particularly because I didn't want their studies, their performance, or anything to be adversely affected. And so I was very careful about who I shared the information with. So I kind of kept it. And each time I've kept it. This time, people can notice a difference because of the weight. And so students will say, oh, you just look so good. And I said, yeah, that's because my liver's only 30 years old. So about that balance, it's difficult. And I have other people who are buoying me up, you know, who say, you got to watch out, be careful, you're working too hard, you're spending too much time, you got to take time for yourself. And that helps, and it keeps me honest.
Talk about the contrast in your life today versus a few years ago, as you were in that sort of stark period where you weren't sure what the next step would be.
Well, the contrast, well, I've always been an overachiever, and I work really hard, and I'm caring about other people. And I have had to step back, and that's hard for my mind to wrap itself around. And yet, I feel as though I am a better person now than I was before. And I understand what things are important and what's not so important.
What do you think would be the most authentic way to give support to somebody who's in the throes of this?
It was hard for me to tell people what it was I needed. And being able to have this space to not know what I needed is rather helpful. I don't even know. People just knew. They knew I needed to eat. There was somebody with me around the clock to try to help me, you know, eat and let me sleep and read, just spending time. And then I realized that those were people that knew me. For me, it's hard to say, because what I did have to learn is to be dependent. And that was a struggle for me, because I'm usually the one who is so independent, and I'm the one that's usually doing things for other people, and that's the way I like it. That's just who I am. And so it was hard for me to acknowledge that I wasn't able to do things the way I had been doing them before.
And when we think about, you know, the American Cancer Society Awareness Campaign, all the different stories that we hear on the forefront, it's often the stories of white women. So as a woman of color who's had to go through this, can you speak to any of the gaps that you've seen?
Yes, there are gaps, in particular with breast cancer, the triple negative breast cancer that happens more among women of color, Latinas and Black women in particular, Asians a little less so, but it is there, and there's little research that's done with that. So yes, I've seen gaps there. I never really felt comfortable. I didn't even give it a chance, to tell the truth, of going to a cancer support group or any of those things that are offered, because I didn't really feel like they were for me. And that could just be the way things are marketed or whatever, but it just was not where I needed to go. So instead, I held my faith close.
Because when we see the marketing for the support group, we often see a group of white women sitting around talking about this, right?
Yes, that's it.
So you had your faith community and other areas for getting support.
Right. And it was what I needed. Again, as I said, I'm kind of an independent person. I'm also fairly private. So it's just been since going through this experience in these last couple of years that I've been a little more open about what's been going on for me and what has happened and where I am right now.
If you had to think about the most important kind of life insight or life lesson you've gained from just this experience, what do you think that would be for you?
Be less judgmental. You don't know where people are, what they've gone through, or what they're going through. Be open to hearing their voices and giving opportunity for other people to share this space. I just realized that I have been really blessed. And I think the second thing that I've learned about this is that I do experience survivor guilt when other people are dying around me who weren't as sick, who have what I have had, who have been through those experiences. I feel bad. And I say in those instances, well, why me? So I'm trying to live that why me in a positive way, because I have something else to give, I suppose. The more things change, the more they stay the same, because I've been a fighter since I was a little kid in a number of ways. I wasn't the one who always accepted everything the teacher said, because, of course, my mom knew more than everybody. So I was like, okay, that has helped me all the way through. Because then when it came to working with medical professionals, I was able to ask critical questions or have people express my voice for me when I wasn't able to, because I wasn't willing to take no for an answer. What has changed is I recognize my vulnerability. I'm not Superwoman, but you wouldn't have been able to tell me that before this experience.
How many times do you think you were told, no, you can't have a transplant?
I don't know how many times it was, but I know it was a full year, because they didn't even see me. They didn't even, okay, we were asking from 2011 when I had that surgery all the way to 2013. And it wasn't until 2013 that they said, well, you know, you could get a live donor. It's like, why didn't you tell us that before? We'd have been looking for 2 years for that. And they said, well, I don't know why you didn't know that. And it's like, because I wasn't told.
And I'm not a doctor.
I'm not a nurse. And they just kept saying no.
Another lesson, though, that I'm just taking away in kind of summation is that you don't have to take no for an answer.
You don't have to take no for an answer. And people think it's trite, but definitely get a second opinion. And I did get a second opinion. Even when I was diagnosed, in terms of, you know, what should happen and how should we move forward. So get a second opinion, get a third opinion. Do some research yourself. We spent time on the internet researching things and looking at prominent hospitals and that knew about this work. I looked for specialists who knew about this particular type of cancer. My sister is also works in the medical field, and so she had a lot of contact with a bunch of surgeons, and she actually works in radiation oncology department. So she had a lot of people that she had contact with, had gone to a conference, and the person who was speaking as the main speaker. He happened to be a specialist in the field and was talking about this particular type of cancer at the conference. What are the odds that she would be attending that conference at that time? And I also found physicians that I was comfortable with working. It wasn't to say that others weren't good, but I needed somebody who mirrored and understood my faith and how strong that was for me, my nutrition, my dietary preferences. I needed people who understood that and understood that I didn't think that medicine, the way we practice it, was the only way for me to be healed. Find people that you can trust and that have your best interest in heart to surround yourself with. Don't be afraid to question. I remember they used to have that question authority. Don't be afraid to question. Don't be afraid to stand up for yourself. And if you can't do it, find someone who will.
Corliss Watkins, thank you for sharing your story with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.